Welcome to the X-Cast, X-Files Podwatch, episode 70. Today we're going to be talking about season 6 episodes, The Unnatural and Three of a Kind. I'm your host, Sarah Blair, and with me is Darren Mooney. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Sarah. Pleased to meet you.
Pleased to meet you, too. I'm so happy to finally get to talk with you.
I know, it's fantastic. One of the great things about the podcast is having the opportunity to kind of to put faces to, but to interact with voices and stuff like that from the podcast and stuff, and to meet other people involved in sort of the X-Cast. Like, it's a fantastic project. I've actually, like, as much as talking about the X-Files is fun, talking about the X-Files with other people like this is also great fun, you know?
Awesome. Well, I'm glad we're here, and let's chat about The Unnatural. This is the 6th season episode that originally aired on April 25th in 1999. Last century. Is written and directed by David Duchovny. What do you think about that? It wasn't the first one he wrote, but it was his directorial debut for the show.
I think it's a pretty amazing accomplishment. I mean, Duchovny is he was one paper away from completing his PhD. He's fascinated by the work of Joseph Campbell. He contributed a great deal to the mythology in the second and third seasons. So, like, Duchovny knows his storytelling and knows how it works. And, like, it's great to actually see him, well, first of all, writing the whole script himself without the assistance of, say, Carter, or, you know, getting a written by as opposed to a story by credit. But as a director, this is a phenomenal accomplishment as well. Like, this is very clearly, one of the things I like about The X-Files as a TV show is the sense that it's almost auteurish in some ways, in the sense, like, different writers and different directors have different voices. So you can tell the difference between, like, a Darren Morgan episode and a Vince Gilligan episode, a James Morgan, Glenn Wong episode, and a Howard Gordon episode. And, like, you can use The X-Files to tell stories that are important or interesting to you, and they're different from the stories that other writers and directors tell that are interesting to them. And, like, one of the things I love about The Unnatural is it's like no other X-Files episode.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's especially great that he got to write and direct it, because that carries over. The feeling of the whole thing just really flows well, and it's a great episode. It's one of my all-time favorites of the show.
It is. Well, it feels very much like this is something that was important to Duchovny, that, like, this was something that he wanted to tell, and, like, the X-Files gave him the capacity to do that, because it's a very unconventionally structured episode, in the sense of it's an episode that doesn't really... Mulder and Scully are there at the beginning and they're there at the end, but they're sort of a framing device for this story that's set in, like, late 1940s Roswell in New Mexico, following this African-American, or this seemingly African-American baseball player. And it's just, like, it's a wonderfully weird story that you never would have imagined that you could tell with The X-Files. But when you watch it, it becomes, like, it makes perfect sense in the context of the show. Because it's about the themes of The X-Files. So it's about, like, alienation. It's about this sense of, like, Americana. It's about this sense of, like, the American continent as a place where magic happens, where sort of myths are formed, where, like, the Greys are this sort of, like, modern fairy tale mythology. Because it is fundamentally, there's something like a fairy tale about the unnatural, where it doesn't necessarily make sense logically, rationally, but it does make sense as a story about a man who wanted to be something more than what he was, who went to America and became that, and was, like, transformed literally and figuratively by his love of baseball. It's just beautiful.
Do you watch baseball yourself?
I have no idea how baseball works. It's like cricket. It's cricket with different bats to me.
I have no idea how cricket works. I tried to learn cricket when I was over in Wales, but it made no sense to me. Baseball, however... I love baseball. So watching it, you can definitely tell that Duchovny's love for the game comes through and really shines. And what you said about the Americana sense of the American dream and all of that, I think is really kind of tied in with baseball, because it's sort of the same idea goes along with the fact that, you know, you can come to America, you can make something amazing of your life if you work hard, and that's sort of our mantra over here. And in baseball, it's sort of the same thing. You know, if you just work hard and you practice hard and do that, you can live this baseball dream of being a great American baseball player. So it sort of goes along with that. But I thought it was interesting that Josh Exley, he can become anything he wants to be, except that he doesn't. He just wants to live his life as this baseball player and actually not be great because he's an alien. So that's sort of kind of, it's how we live our life. We just want to live our lives and enjoy our dreams here. So I really liked that aspect of it.
Well, I mean, even Exley, the way that Exley talks about, like, the alien society, where it's places where there is no sense of difference and there's a rigid hierarchy and stuff like that, that in many ways, I think, reflects the way that, like, Americans think of, like, the old world, like Europe and stuff like that, where you have a much more stringent sense of class and social hierarchy. That the joy of America, in many ways, as an ideal, is that you can go to it, and whether you arrive as a pauper or whether you arrive with money in your pocket, whether you're white or whether you're black in theory, like, you can make something of yourself and you can become something magical, and you can do what you want to do. You are not confined in the way that you are with, say, the rigid hierarchies of Europe, for example, like with Britain or with France, where you have these sort of these understandings of how things are supposed to work. Like, the joy of America, I think, ideally, or sort of like as an ideal, is the sense that it's a country that is so young that it's finding itself, and you can find yourself in it. And like Exley sort of talks about this, like, the beauty of the game baseball is not necessarily anything that's pure or rational or logical or objective. The joy of the game of baseball is that it's a game. It's fun. It's something that exists to bring pleasure to the people who are playing it and to the pleasure of the people who are watching it. And like that's the majesty of it.
Absolutely. It's once you step on that field or you're watching, everybody's equal. Yeah, I really like that aspect of it. And I think that totally came through in the episode too. What were some of your favorite parts?
I mean, I liked a lot of it. I love the fact that, like, I particularly love the character of Arthur Dales as played by M. Emmett Walsh, who's filling in for Darren McGavin, who played the role previously in Travelers and also in Aguamala. But one of the things I like is the fact that Duchovny is well aware of the fact that, like, some people watching this episode, some sort of continuity-obsessed people, are going to wonder how this all fits in with the mythology. You know, how does this sort of reveal about the Roswell crash comment on this grand mythology that was tied up in two fathers and one son? And, like, there's this really great conversation where basically Arthur Dales has this conversation about how meaningless the story is. But that's what gives it its meaning, where it's like, do you believe a man can be transformed by love? And then at the end, you have Exley, who is literally transformed by love into a real live boy. He becomes human at the end. He starts bleeding red. And there's this idea that while the story maybe doesn't make sense logically from, like, a continuity point of view or in terms of fitting with the mythology, it fits perfectly thematically, because there is, like, purity control is an idea that's been part of the alien mythology since, like, the end of the first season, the Erlenmeyer flask. But, like, here you have the unnatural using that as a metaphor for racism and for prejudice, where the alien bounty hunter, you know, shows up as a KKK member. And you get this sort of sense that Duchovny is, like, it's not that he's ignoring the mythology or the conspiracy or anything like that, but that he's using the themes of it to tell the story that he wants to tell. Because, like, one of the big themes of the mythology is the idea, like, hybridization and diversity are great things and they make us stronger, as opposed to purity, which is, you know, something that is toxic and harmful and a bunch of, like, white men who control the world. Whereas in The Unnatural, you have that play out just in a different way. So you have this idea of, like, a black baseball player in, you know, the 1940s who's accepted through the sport. And one of the great things is the beautiful scene at the start where, like, when the KKK show up, the white players, because they've been playing with Exley, they stand with him because baseball is the great leveler and brings everybody together.
And Dick Hebney's portrayal of this was so masterful. Like you were talking about, he just, you know, blended it all together so well. I love the, you know, being a shipper. I love the
closing scene.
Yeah, the closing and the opening scene. I really liked seeing Duchovny and Anderson being so playful together. Because usually they're, Mulder and Scully are on a case and it's serious. And I always enjoy those moments where they can really break loose and just be friends. I think it's important to show the intense moments, but also the other side of them, because, you know, they are humans between episodes or whatever. They hang out together and all that kind of stuff. So that was fun to see. Like, do you think we'll see Arthur Dales, the sister, in season 11?
I don't think so. I suspect that he's sort of fallen by the wayside. Like, I love the audacity of the ridiculousness of the concept of Arthur Dales, where they also had a goldfish named Arthur Dales,
yeah.
Where it's very clearly Duchovny sort of, like, trolling in a way, where he's like, well, look, I obviously wrote this role for Darren McGavin, but he wasn't available. So I changed the script as little as possible and slotted it in Emma Walsh. And rather than just ignoring it or glossing over it, I turned it into this big recurring gag to point out how absurd and ridiculous it is. Like, Emma Walsh is fantastic. He's a great actor. You probably know him from stuff like Blade Runner and stuff like that. He was in Calvary over here in Ireland as well. And he's really, really good. And he's very good at playing with Mulder as well. Like the scene where he's at the gin bottle that arrives and stuff like that. Or the tell me a story and you're paying for coffee.
Yeah. Poor boy.
But I love the, and you're right about the closing scene with Mulder and Scully, because like one of the things, the sixth and seventh seasons come in for a lot of criticism for not being as serious and heavy as the first five. And you know, there's an extent to which I feel like maybe the stories weren't as consistently good, the standalone stories weren't as consistently good. But one of the things that I really love about the sixth and seventh season is the sense that you get of Mulder and Scully as friends. And it's not just in The Unnatural. It's even in little scenes in later episodes, like maybe Jesu Haith, for example, which we may or may not be talking about at some point in the future. But like this little sense that Mulder and Scully have, like, they are friends. They're not just co-workers now, they're best friends. And whether or not you believe that they're anything more or anything less, like, there is a sense that these are just two people who have found each other in the world, which I really, really like.
And I love how he captured that. Is there anything that we don't like about this episode? I mean, it's hard to pinpoint.
I'm actually struggling to think, because I love all the guest performances as well. Frederick Lane is the young Arthur Dales. I love Jesse L. Martin as Joss Exene.
Oh, yeah.
Martin is great. He's been great in everything. I think he was in Law and Order, but he was also in The Flash, if you watch The Flash at the moment. But he's very, very good. Martin has this wonderful, casual charisma to him, and he's just really great in this.
Our second episode of the day is Three of a Kind. And this episode originally aired on May 2nd, 1999, and it was written by Vince Gilligan and John Scheiben. It was directed by Brian Spicer, and this is a Lone Gunman episode. What did you think about it? We've got Suzanne Modesky back.
You've also got a whole host of setup for the Lone Gunman spinoff. So you have, like, Brian Spicer, the director, would become the go-to director for the spinoff. You have the character of Jimmy the Geek, who would get... He's killed off in this episode, but they love Jim Fife so much they brought back him as Kimmy the Geek, the twin brother, who you never knew about. I'm on the record of saying, like, I am a huge fan of Unusual Suspects, which was the fifth season Lone Gunman episode. I think that's like a top 15 episode for me. Three of a Kind is less good. I think it's a lot less good. And part of my issue with it is that it does a thing that I think a lot of sixth season episodes do, where there's a sense of they're trying to move some stories forward or to develop some ideas or to get characters, like, moving forward, but they're also reluctant to commit to anything that would fundamentally change the show. And, like, with Three of a Kind, you have this story, which is fascinating because it's a sequel to Unusual Suspects, where Suzanne Modesky, who is the love of John Fitzgerald Byer's life, she comes back into his life later on, and he meets up, he discovers that she's part of some conspiracy, and he manages to free her, and he manages to do what he couldn't do in Unusual Suspects, which is he manages to help Suzanne get out from under the government, you know, the military industrial complex, and to find herself and to give her freedom. But at the very end of the episode, for some reason, Byers doesn't go with her, because that would break up the Lone Gunman. That would mean that they would have to fundamentally change the dynamic of the group and change something that is considered core to the show. So for something that Byers has pursued and chased and wanted and loved for the past, like, since 1989, I think, when The Unusual Suspects was set, he finally has that opportunity to follow through and live his dream, and he doesn't. And the episode never provides a convincing case for why he wouldn't choose to go with Suzanne Modesky. And that's a big problem for me, because it gives a sense of closure, but it gives a sense of closure that doesn't feel earned to me.
Exactly. That made me so mad. You know, I'm all for love and romance and all that stuff. You know, I write all the steamy stuff in my books, so I'm excited when the characters can finally find true love, and then it didn't happen. And I was like, wait, what is he? He's just spent this whole, and you open the episode with his dream, and he's got the kids, and he's got her, and everything is beautiful, and that's his idea of what this all could be. And then at the end, he could go with her. They could run off to the beach and live their lives and make lots of buyer's babies, and life would be great. And then he chooses Frohickey and Langley. Like, why would you want to choose them?
I love Frohickey and Langley, but I can tell that's a bad call.
Right? I mean, you could be with Suzanne Modesky, the love of your life, or you could be with those guys.
Yeah, the creepy guys who you met trying to steal cable. I love them both, but you can keep in contact with them. You can email them. You can go on vacations with them.
You can make scrambled phone calls to each other. It did not make sense at all.
But I mean, you talked about there a moment ago the opening scene, because the opening scene is actually one of my favorite parts of the sixth season as a whole, because it's this wonderful long take. And I mean, obviously, when you're talking about long takes in the sixth season, you're going to be talking about Triangle, mm-hmm. which is an episode built of long takes. But there's this beautiful shot of Byers going into his house, and it follows him through this idealized house. And he has this sort of wonderful monologue where he's talking about, like, the thing about the Lone Gunman that makes them different from Mulder, well, there are several things, is the fact that, first of all, they don't have the same sense of success or epic scale that Mulder has. So Mulder has a cigarette-smoking man, the Lone Gunman don't really have anything like that. They fail continuously, they're crazy. Mulder, on the other hand, is investigating a conspiracy that is true and that he can defeat or expose in some way, shape, or form. So Mulder's a hero, and these guys are, like, just failures, in a way that's lovable and charming. But one of the things I really like about the Lone Gunman is the sense that Mulder is an embodiment of, like, 70s anxiety. So he's, like, the parallax view, or the Manchurian Candidate, or the, like, post-Watergate, post-Vietnam. The Lone Gunman always worked very well for me as an embodiment of, like, 60s. Like, 60s nostalgia. They sort of embodied the Kennedy dream that was sort of, that ended in Dallas. This idea of the new frontier, a possible bright future where everything could be beautiful. And, like, they never let go of that. And in some ways, that's why they've been left behind. And one of the things I really love about the opening scene of basically the Three of a Kind is that Byers says, look, in this perfect world, you know, John F. Kennedy was never shot, and America has faith in its institutions and faith in its government, and this is the world where they want to live in, and this is the world where they've been left behind. And just the beautiful sweeping shot of Byers standing alone in the desert is one of the most, like, evocative images of the Lone Gunman. It's so affecting and so powerful, and nothing in the episode lives up to that.
Definitely. So what do you think about the brief but distinct reappearance of Morris Fletcher?
Fletcher's fantastic, because Michael McKean is fantastic. Obviously, he went on to work with Gilligan on Better Call Saul and stuff like that, where mm-hmm. he's also fantastic. And I mean, one of the things that, like, this is much more of a setup for the Lone Gunman TV show than Unusual Suspects. This is practically like a stealth pilot for it, because Morris Fletcher goes on to become a recurring Lone Gunman character. He appears in All About Eve, which was the first season finale that was cancelled, and he goes on to appear in Jump the Shark in the ninth season. And, like, I like the idea of, like, Morris Fletcher as the cigarette smoking man for the Lone Gunman, or as a character who brushes up against them, because, like, the cigarette smoking man is scary and terrifying and all powerful, and Morris Fletcher is just this lechy, pervy, like, middle management dude whose idea of being evil is inhabiting Mulder's body and, like, getting a waterbed. So I feel like he's the right level for them, and I feel like I just like seeing him again. I know that, and, like, the Three of a Kind is not a good episode, but I really like Gillian Anderson, where she's doped up on the drug, because it's just fantastic. Because it's just like when she's asked to give the cause of death for Jimmy the Bean, and she's like, bop. You can tell Anderson is having great fun, and it is contagious. It's the one part of the episode where I feel like the fun sort of mood carried.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun to see her break out and really get the opportunity to be a little bit different in that. So, yeah. And how do you feel about the location of Las Vegas? I feel it could have been set pretty much anywhere, and these conspiracy people choose Vegas of all places with, like, so many people and everything to have this clandestine meeting.
Part of me is sort of like, I understand that the Las Vegas thing is because Las Vegas happens to be near Los Angeles where they were filming. So, like, where can we go that's somewhere vaguely exotic but within sort of reasonable distance? But I also
with the desert background.
That's it, exactly. But I like the idea that the guys conspiring in this mythology episode are middle management. They're like pencil pushers. So it's like, yes, of course they'd want an expenses paid trip to Las Vegas, like any other industry, where it'd be like, because it is, it's that sort of thing where you have people who go to conferences, and conferences are just a pretense for expense accounts.
Exactly.
And I like this idea of, like, because obviously Mulder tends to deal with people who actually believe in what they're doing, and people who are like very devoted to this cause, and who deal in stakes that are like the survival of mankind. I just like the idea that there are middle management conspiracy types who are like, yeah, so I'm going to Vegas. I'm going to expense the hell out of this trip. I'm going to get a suite. It's going to be fantastic. I'm going to pretend that I went to some seminars. I'm probably going to sleep in and miss a couple. I'm probably not going to attend the mind control one, but I might go see the one about like self-flying jets. You know, it'll be grand.
Yeah.
And like Morris Fletcher, who's clearly going there to like pick up women who aren't his wife. But like, it is that embodiment of like a very banal sort of evil, because it is like the mythology tends to deal with these big absolute forms of evil. But I think that like with this, and I think you see it a lot in Gilligan's episodes, and with, say, even in Morris Fletcher in Dreamland, there's this idea of an evil that is more generic and more familiar to us, in that like, in my professional working environment, I have rarely met people who are conspiring with aliens to conquer the world. I have, however, met people who are just horrible douchebags who, you know, are willing to use, say, expense accounts for whatever purpose that they see fit, and who are willing to do stuff like use excuses to travel overseas to do, you know, to step out or whatever. Like, it's a more banal and generic form of evil that you encounter, but I don't think it's any less valid. And I quite like the idea of the lone gunman operating on that scale, as opposed to with Mulder, you know, as opposed to like, you know, chase it through mine shafts and stuff.
I kind of consider the lone gunman, I mean, they've got their three little individual characters and everything, but they're sort of a whole as well. So it sort of encapsulates, you know, their level, like you said, they're sort of the middle management of the myth arc in the X-Files. Well, I think that about covers everything. That's it for us today, folks. So I hope you'll come find us on Twitter at @thex_cast. And let us know what your thoughts are for today's episode over at our Facebook group. Coming up on our next episode, we'll be talking about Field Trip and Biogenesis. So we'll definitely be looking forward to those two. And until next time, trust no one.